This is the Crystal Ball Run Podcast. My name is Kevin McGuire, managing editor of CrystalBallRun.com, and I want to remind you guys to check out the website. Again, it's CrystalBallRun.com. You can give us a follow on Twitter at CrystalBallRun. Like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/CrystalBallRun. You can also check us out on Google Plus. We have a newsletter that goes out once a week, so make sure you're subscribed to that. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. Do that today. Leave a review, leave a rating. We'd really appreciate your feedback. Of course, everything can be found at CrystalBallRun.com, and today we are talking about National Signing Day. And if you've checked out the website recently, you've seen some of the flashbacks that we've done to some of the recruiting classes of the past, taking a look at some of the running backs and the wide receivers and the quarterbacks from just a couple of years ago to see how they panned out. We're also going to be having some content coming up your way to look at National Signing Day from a number of different perspectives. But today, we are happy to be joined today by ESPN's National Recruiting Director, Tom Luginbill, who's joining us to talk a little bit about ESPN's coverage for National Signing Day on Wednesday, February 5th. 11 straight hours of coverage on ESPNU. It's going to be a lot of fun for a lot of us. We will be talking to him about a number of different topics around the country. A lot of SEC talk, some James Franklin at Penn State, Charlie Strong at Texas, Pac-12 recruiting, and how much of a bump does winning a national championship give you leading up to National Signing Day just a few weeks later. We talk about all that stuff right now with Tom Luginbill from ESPN. And I'm joined now by Tom Luginbill. He's the ESPN National Recruiting Director. And Tom, I'm sure this is a real busy time for you, I guess, with National Signing Day right around the corner. You know, things are getting a little exciting on your end.
Well, they are. It's obviously a busy time of year. You head down the stretch to National Signing Day, and for us at ESPNU, and when you're putting together such a daunting project of airing a broadcast for 11 straight hours live, you know, it's so much of election style coverage because information's coming in and you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants. But the preparation work by so many people behind the scenes that goes into making that day for us so special. It's a lot of fun to be a part of it, and February 6th.
I'm sure that's the case. You know, for me, every time National Signing Day comes around, I generally have two TVs on, and one of them was always locked in on ESPN's coverage, because every year, the last couple of years, it's really been increasing in value, and really the kind of content that you guys are pumping out is just amazing to me. You know, for college football junkies like I, it's something to really grab onto, and I really appreciate what you guys do. Let's talk a little bit about what you guys are doing. Like you said, you guys are going to be doing 11 straight hours of coverage on ESPNU on National Signing Day, which of course is Wednesday, February 5th. It's going to kick off at 8 a.m. You'll have, I think, 13 live announcements scheduled to happen throughout the day. And of course, you have tremendous on-site coverage at some of the biggest schools out there. Tom Rinaldi at Alabama, Holly Rowe at Florida State, Pedro Gomez at Penn State. That's just to name a few. You know, after what you guys did with the BCS championship game, I have to imagine that you guys maybe taking some cues on what you guys did there and leading that into what you're doing with Recruiting Day.
Well, you know, it's hard to enter all those dynamics into it, or even some of them, just because, as I mentioned, with such a unique property as National Signing Day, and with letters of intent coming in by the minute. You know, generally when you go into a television broadcast, you have what's called a rundown, and things are scripted out. Who's going to say what? Who wants to make this point? How much time you have to make it? But this is a little bit more of an open forum of analysis and reaction, almost more than anything else throughout the course of the day. But what I would like to think that we've done a really good job of is, as this show has grown and matured. Back in 2006, it was 6 hours live, and everybody thought that was a daunting task. And now it's, the last year was 12, now we're back to 11. I think the thing that we've done a good job is integrating a lot of voices, a lot of opinions, but not just simply talking about, okay, who's this best player or who's that best player? You know, what do they do and where are they going? We try to integrate what are the challenges in recruiting, what's the day-to-day process that these coaches are going through, what are the ins and outs and the little nuances that maybe the general fan doesn't understand that these coaches are dealing with each and every day. And with an 11-hour broadcast, you have the time to kind of cover everything, but we always think it's really important to dive into the process, because that's the area that people probably are the most unfamiliar with.
Yeah, definitely. And that's really why when you have so much time to dive deep into this stuff, that's really where the best part of the content really shines as far as I'm concerned. So let me ask you some questions about recruiting and National Signing Day as we're getting closer to it. Obviously, there are still some holes that are going to need to be filled between now and National Signing Day, maybe beyond that. But when you're looking at some of the classes that are being put together right now, with what we've seen, who have been some of the schools that have done the best to address some of their needs already?
Well, you know, the first school that comes to mind for me is the Tennessee Volunteers, and they could end up being a class this year that is very similar to the class that Ole Miss experienced a year ago. And, you know, Butch Jones, now into his first full calendar year as a head coach there with his staff, has an opportunity to lay down their blueprint and really start to develop the philosophy and the identity of what he wants to put the Tennessee program to be all about. Well, he now also had time to go through spring football with his football team a year ago, start to identify needs and areas of weakness and where they needed to upgrade. And I think he's done a really good job of that in a couple of distinct areas. He's done an excellent job of it in the offensive skill spots. And you know, that was something where playmakers were lacking. You lose David Rogers, you lose Justin Hunter, and now all of a sudden you're kind of starting over a little bit. So they needed to go out and get guys like Josh Malone and bring in some athletes that could really upgrade the position. LaVon Pearson, our number two ranked overall player in our ESPN JUCO 50. And then I also think in the defensive line, at linebacker and in the offensive line are the areas that they've had the most distinct needs that they've addressed. Now, right now, Tennessee's got 34 prospects in this class, 14 of which were mid-year enrollees and are already in school, which is very, very important for Tennessee.
So glad you mentioned Tennessee, because Butch Jones is a guy that wasn't a real popular hire at the time, but I always thought that he was going to do a pretty decent job if you gave him some time to work and really do what he's been doing. So I'm really looking forward to see what he does with that. But you know, let's stick in that same division with the SEC East. So obviously, recruiting in the SEC can be somewhat easier than in some other conferences, but it's also highly competitive. I'm sure you know that better than nobody, or better than anybody, I'm sorry. But some of the other schools that are in this division are pretty interesting to watch. Coming off a disappointing year of Florida, obviously looking for some spark in all the offensive side of the football, I'm sure. Georgia, obviously, is going to have some holes to fill in over time. You know, what are some of the other schools you're watching in that division closely?
Well, I think Florida, without question, is kind of the team that's maybe been a bit of a surprise. I think a lot of people made assumptions that over the last 4 or 5 months and the tumultuous year they had on the field, mostly due to such significant injuries that I don't think anybody could have recovered, that program or that class would just crumble. And they've had some guys like Dalvin Cook and wide receiver Ermon Lane decide to depart, but then within a week or two of that happening, they flip Thomas Holly from Penn State, and then they go out and get Jalen Tabor, the corner out of Maryland, and they kind of revitalize their stature. So there's a lot of positive buzz about Florida right now going down the stretch. Georgia, in my opinion, is doing a really good job in one distinct area, and that is recruiting in anticipation of players departing early for the NFL draft, because that's what a lot of these programs are having to do now. You don't have the luxury of saying, all right, we've got this guy for 4 to 5 years. In many instances, you might have him for three. Mm-hmm. So Georgia's expecting that they might lose Todd Gurley next year. They might lose Keith Marshall if he comes back healthy next year. They better address the running back position, which they've done with Nick Chubb and Sony Michel. So I think Georgia's done a nice job in that area. I think if there's one program that you've got to look at, you've got to have a lot of respect for, it's South Carolina, because while they've gotten a Jadeveon Clowney and they've gotten a Connor Shaw before, a Jazz Sutton, and maybe an Alshon Jeffrey, by and large, you're not looking at top 10 classes. You're looking at top 15, top 20 classes that they have developed into a top 10 program. I think there's a lot to be said for that, Dee Spurrier, and the job that he's done. And he's done it predominantly with defensive personnel and offensive personnel that, you know, even though you have a Mike Davis or a Marcus Lattimore, it hasn't been as flashy as maybe his days at Florida, but it still doesn't mean that it's not the right way to go about it. And I think South Carolina's done a nice job of that.
And I think a lot of that goes into actually developing the talent. I mean, it's one thing to bring in 4-star, 5-star recruits, but what you do with them once you get your hands on them and put them through the practices, I think that's really probably more valuable than anything else.
Well, there's no question. And players develop at different rates. You know, some guys just absolutely have to redshirt because mentally and physically they're not ready. some guys come right in and it just pops. It just happens for them. But they don't hit the freshman wall. They can handle all the responsibility, whether it's being away from home or waking up at 5 a.m. for winter workouts or being at study hall when you're supposed to be there in training and all these sorts of things that can consume a young freshman. Some guys are ready for that. Some guys aren't. And you know, it's funny that you make mention of that because we often believe at ESPN that there are way too many five-star labels placed upon players. If there were as many five-star players out there coming out of high school as some of these recruiting sites say there are, there would be 30 or 40 true freshmen making an impact every single year in college football. And the reality is there's not. There's 5 to 10 tops on a good year. And so I think you got to be careful when you label these guys. Most guys need to develop. Most guys aren't ready. Most players need to come in and get a sense of what's expected and the level of play that they are now entrenched in. And it's not an easy climb. And so I think that if you can develop and if you coach, if you can bring guys along slowly, and this is an important one, if you're at a program that still has the luxury of being able to redshirt the majority of their classes, the depth of your roster over the long haul will be really beneficial.
When it comes to a player's individual learning curve, is there a way to kind of kind of scout that ahead of time so coaches know how long it may take to develop a player? Or is it just really something that you don't really know until you get them to get into your practice and get into your system?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. Coaches want to do things in a manner which ensures that they're not only getting a good player. That actually becomes the easy part of the evaluation, is the talent and the physical ability. The difficult part, it becomes projecting what type of guy you're getting, what's his competitive temperament, what is his mental toughness, is he mature enough to handle responsibility, can he handle every single day something as simple as setting an alarm clock and getting up without mommy and daddy tapping him on the shoulder. And that may sound trivial, but it's unbelievably true how much it applies to people. The little thing that can affect just how quickly you make the jump to the next level, and oftentimes they have nothing to do with a physical trait. So These coaches are doing everything they can to try and investigate those properties. The problem is, with the NCAA, they limit the amount of time and amount of contact that you can have with these prospects to investigate the person as much as you're investigating the player, and that's what makes it difficult, because oftentimes an unknown variable will manifest itself after you've already gotten them that could have a dramatic effect on whether the player's going to succeed or whether he's going to fail.
Talking to ESPN's National Recruiting Director, Tom Luganbill. Tom, we were just talking about the SEC East a little bit. One school we didn't mention was Vanderbilt. Obviously, I think that's a pretty important story as well, regarding what's going on with Vanderbilt, having lost some recruits to James Franklin, their former head coach up at Penn State. And that's another topic I want to get onto real quick. But how does Derek Mason come in here and kind of try to keep the momentum going at Vanderbilt? Or does he kind of take a mulligan this year with whatever he's going to be able to pull together and really focus hard on the 2015.
Well, I know that as a coach and a competitor, he will not accept a mulligan, but he's going to be given one anyway, because this class has been decimated by the move of James Franklin to Penn State. It's really gone from being something that was a top 25, top 30 class for us just over 10 days ago to being a class that has dwindled down to 10 verbal commitments right now, and a lot of uncertainty. And where Derek Mason has challenges is now with the new recruiting rules and the extended dead period that used to just be the last 2 weeks in December and now extends into the first 2 weeks of January, you're really limiting the time in which you as a coaching staff can get on the road. As a coaching staff, you can host prospects on campus. So they're really under a crunch time at Vanderbilt right now. And I think over the long haul, they'll be okay. But this is going to be a difficult class to close out with. Keep in mind, if they don't get the numbers in this class that they'd like to have with the limited amount of time they have to close, those scholarships will be paid forward to the next year, which could lend to them having a big, solid class in the 2015 group.
Very true. And of course, James Franklin up at Penn State has been kind of impressing some people from what I've seen. He's, like we said, he's managed to flip a couple of Vanderbilt kids. He's brought in some pretty interesting talent as far as what the recruiting notebooks are saying out there right now. Where do you see James Franklin going at Penn State? Obviously, it looks like things are going to get easier as far as recruiting is concerned with the amount of scholarships he'll have. And of course, there's only 2 years left on that postseason ban. How much of it is James Franklin being a successful recruiter wondering how much of it is the fact that Penn State is now 2 years removed from everything that went down in 2011.
Well, I think one plays hand in hand with the other. First and foremost, James Franklin is a grinder. He's a worker. He's got an energetic personality, a magnetic personality that resonates with prospective student athletes. I think that's been evidenced tenfold by what he was able to accomplish in a short period of time at Vanderbilt. And so you know he's going to go in with energy, and you know people are going to like what he has to say. I think in combination with that, he has caught this program at the right time because there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not an oncoming freight train. And so you're right. You do get to sell that last year's class and this year's class will play in a bowl game. They will compete for championships, and every class going forward is going to have more opportunities to do so. The NCAA has given some of their scholarships back, so the roster is now going to get a little bit more inflated, although not to the point that it needs to be. I think the biggest surprise, and this goes back to even when Bill O'Brien was hired, about Penn State, is everybody knew they'd be in trouble in terms of sheer numbers. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody anticipated, including myself, that the caliber of player that would be considering or even look to sign with Penn State would be what it has been. Whether it's been a Christian Hackenberg or a tight end Adam Brenneman or the receivers DeAndre Tompkins and Chris Godwin in this current class, who, by the way, guys, all enrolled, as well as Michael Connor, the quarterback, without James Franklin being hired. That's how committed they were to Penn State. And so I think James Franklin has a lot going for him. This program has a very positive perception on behalf of prospective student athletes, and that more than anything will count at the end of the day. How does the prospect perceive you as a program?
I think it's going to be fascinating to watch the recruiting battles between James Franklin and Urban Meyer. You can throw Brady Hoke into the mix as well. And don't forget about Mark D'Antonio either.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. This conference has gotten competitive with good player evaluators like Urban Meyer, as you mentioned. I think Mark D'Antonio does as good as anybody at developing players. And then now James Franklin, Gary Anderson at Wisconsin is one of the best coaches in all of college football. That thing's going to keep rolling. And so I think it's a good sign for hopefully an upswing in Big Ten football.
Down at Texas, Charlie Strong, again, not a real popular hire, depending on who you ask for. I think it's a great hire, first of all, but I'm really curious to see what he does. It looks like he's struggling to keep the class of 2014 up to a high par, but I have expectations that he's going to do pretty well there of recruiting. I think the 2015 is going to be, again, sort of like with Derek Mason and Vanderbilt under different circumstances, but I think 2015 will be more of a testament to what Charlie Strong's going to be able to do at Texas. What are you seeing with the Longhorns and Charlie Strong era getting underway?
Well, this class still has 21 verbal commitments that are intact. That is more than enough, and they are competitive enough and good enough talent-wise to probably be the best class of any incoming coach to this point. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the biggest challenge that lies ahead for Charlie Strong and his staff is to be able to implement their plan, their philosophy, and their player personnel evaluation approach, and not cowering or giving in to pressure of what everybody else says they should be doing. Everybody that says, oh, well, you got to take this guy, he's a 4-star. You got to take this guy, he's a 5-star. What Charlie Strong and his staff need to do is take the guys that they think are the best for them, not what anybody else thinks. So if they want to go out and recruit a Johnny Manziel that nobody knows about, they're going to take heat for it, but they've got to dig their heels. And if they're going to go out and recruit old Michael James that nobody recruited, then you know what? You go do that, and you believe in it, and you own it, and you dig your heels in. That's going to be the most difficult thing to do, because with the fan base, with the state, with the history and the tradition, and so many high-profile players wanting to come to Texas, the question is selecting the right ones. And I think they need to start getting away from having so many early verbal commitments from sophomores and juniors and start evaluating longer so that these prospects are hungrier and aren't given anything. Because what's happened is I think a lot of complacency is set in with prospects that from the moment they could walk, wanted to play in Texas, and then when they got the opportunity to, all of a sudden there was no incentive, there was no hunger, there was no chip on their shoulder, and that has not been good for this program. Those are all areas that I think Charlie Strong has to avoid and has to make sure he has a plan for going forward with his Texas program. It will get harder before it gets easier if he takes that route.
How much of an impact do you think Texas A&M going to the SEC has had on recruiting in the state of Texas now that we're a couple years in? And I guess on a related note, how has it impacted Texas at all?
Oh, I think it's significant. It's, you know, perception is nine-tenths of reality, as I mentioned earlier. And right now, the SEC is perceived to be the top dog in college football, and it has been, and it is. And so, you know, the conference lure, the destinations for road games, the amount of television exposure, all of those things come into play. You have a network now in the SEC network, and then you couple that with the fact that, that surprisingly A&M came in 2 years ago and kind of lit the world on fire with an 11-2 season, which people didn't expect, obviously the Heisman Trophy, to kind of lit the fuse, and now all of a sudden the snowball's effect of momentum really starts to gain exposure. And that really, I think, had a bigger effect on Texas than anything Texas on the field was doing. Even though Texas struggled 2 years ago and then bounced back to 9-4, 3 years ago, bounced back to 9-4 2 years ago, again went bowling this past year, that wasn't as much of a negative effect on Texas and their recruiting as all the positive momentum and buzz was an effect on Texas for Texas A&M. And so it'll be interesting to see if Texas A&M can sustain, because if they don't start getting better on defense, they're going to struggle to sustain in the SEC. And if Texas can regain some of that exposure, some of that buzz, and get back on top.
Tom, I've got two more questions for you if you have the time. The first one I definitely want to touch on is outside or out west on the Pac-12, things are getting a little more interesting as well. Coaching impact and coaching profiles have really increased the last couple of years. That's going to continue to be the case with Chris Peterson taking over at Washington, and it looks like he's having some success early on with his recruiting as well. How much of an impact do you think Chris Peterson's going to have at Washington, and really what are you looking at in the Pac-12 this National Signing Day?
Well, I think time will tell with Washington. The proof's in the pudding with Chris Peterson as a coach, as an evaluator, as a developer of players. He's catching this Washington program in a much better state than when Steve Sarkisian took it over. I think this he's going to be getting a flyer on this recruiting class, although he has brought in a quarterback in Austin Carter Samuels, which I think was Kyle Carter Samuels. He's the brother of Austin Carter Samuels. But I think that was very, very important. He needs a full calendar year, and this happened so late. And it's an opportunity now with the new facility, the new stadium renovations in Washington. Chris Peterson has a very deep, respected root of recruiting in the state of California, which is critical for the survival of Washington football. I think they have a bright future ahead of them. The question for me is going to be how USC closes on signing day. They could have a monster day on February 5th if they close the way I think they are capable of closing. Because, you know, with prospects don't like two things. Instability, and they don't like uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And for the last, 7 to 8 months, that's what this USC program has had, uncertainty and instability on the future of the program and the future of the leadership of the program. The moment they made that change, and then it went dead or drawn, now it's gone to Steve Sarkisian, you're starting to see USC kind of regroup, gain some momentum, and more than anything else, solidifying the leadership and the future of the program, reinstitutes confidence in the prospects, particularly on the West Coast. So I anticipate maybe not SC cleaning up with remaining prospects, but I think SEC will close very nicely, and you're going to start seeing them get their scholarships back. So they're going to get back up the full complement roster, which is going to be very important.
Last thing I wanted to touch on with you is obviously Florida State's coming off a BCS championship, and you know what Jimbo Fisher has been doing with recruiting since he's taken over as head coach has really been pretty incredible, and that Florida State team's not going away for anytime soon, I think. But my question really is more, when a team comes off a BCS championship, how much of a jump and how much of a spike does that give them in the recruiting in the last few weeks leading up to National Signing Day from your experience?
Far more in the classes to come than in the current class. The current class has already been largely committed, largely entrenched in what was an Orange Bowl victory 2 years ago under E.J. Manuel's leadership, and then now, of course, a national title and a Heisman Trophy under Jameis Winston's leadership. But over the course of that Orange Bowl win, leading to this national championship win, the 2014 class was largely on board, has been, and now all of a sudden, you'll start to see, I think, an even bigger uptick, and I think a more competitive Florida State, again, against its SEC foes like Alabama, LSU, Georgia, and Florida, because at the end of the day, when it comes to the premium positions, offensive line, defensive line, quarterback, and cornerback, that's where Florida State has built this team. That's where they've beaten SEC teams on premier players, guys like Tim Jernigan, guys like Mario Edwards, players like Christian Jones at linebacker, Jalen Ramsey at safety, Ronald Darby at corner, LaMarcus Joyner at corner. Those guys are all premium players at premium positions. And then, of course, we all know the offensive line and James Winston at quarterback. And so yes. I think you'll continue to see a push with those four positions from Florida State and an ultra-competitive landscape of recruiting now, because I think prospects view Florida State as a team no different than they view in Alabama or let's just say a Florida or an Ohio State or a Texas or a USC when it comes to those types of premium positions and playing championship caliber football.
Tom Luganbill, ESPN's National Recruiting Director. Again, ESPN News coverage, 11 straight hours on National Signing Day, which is Wednesday, February 5th, starting at 8 a.m. Eastern. Again, 13 live announcements on the schedule and 12 on-site reporters, at least 12, I guess. It's going to be a lot of stuff to cover on National Signing Day, so I wish you all the best of luck. I know it's going to be real busy for you leading up to then, and really looking forward to see what you guys do over there.
Well, you bet. Thanks for having me, man.
My thanks to Tom Luganbill and the folks over at ESPN for helping set that up for you. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Hopefully you'll subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. You can check us out on Podomatic as well. And just a reminder that if you do subscribe in iTunes, you actually get to listen to our podcast earlier than they are released on the website, crystalballrun.com. So there's a benefit to being a subscriber, of course. So make sure you do that. Hopefully, again, if you leave a rating, leave a review, we'd really appreciate it. Again, crystalballrun.com. You can follow us on Twitter at crystalballrun. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/crystalballrun. We're also on Google+. We've got a YouTube channel. And, of course, we have that newsletter as well that goes out once a week, so make sure you subscribe to that. You can find all the information right on crystalballrun.com. We'll have all the links in the show notes for this, and make sure you do that. Again, I'm Kevin McGuire. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin on CFB. And until next time, everybody, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you later.